Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome from Chicago here on a nice, steamy, hot Wednesday morning. In this podcast, we have the privilege of speaking with Mr. Joel Blyberg. He is the Director of Sales Engineering for Opora Company. They're based out of Israel and have offices in the New York City area. Joel, thank you for your time this morning, and especially thank you for joining us for this podcast.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Joel, so your bio shows that you have a deep and rich background in cybersecurity, and we were just talking about your doctorate in chemistry. What are some of the highlights of your career, and what kind of got you to on the path where you are at today?
Oh, that's a great question, Ravi. So, my background is fairly extensive. My title here at Opora is Director of Sales Engineering. So, you know, I've got about 20 years or more of sales engineering experience. And that goes over a number of areas, not solely cybersecurity, which is something I've kind of transitioned into over the years, but I've worked in, endpoint to data protection, unified communication collaboration, threat management, and these days at Opora, my past few posts have been more in the lines of cyber protection and cybersecurity. But my highlights are, you know, I, as you said, and made reference to the doctorate I have, which is actually in chemistry, so it has no real bearing on cybersecurity. But what it did was give me a very good background in research, which is obviously something you need in information technology, and especially in cybersecurity. So that ability to, you know, take a large amount of information, go through it and summarize it, especially for non-technical people, is something that I pride myself in.
Okay, I believe Ronan, your CEO, just joined in. Ronan?
Yes, hi everyone.
Hi Ronan, thank you for joining in. Ronan, we just got started. Tell us about your background and how you got started here in cybersecurity.
So I started my career 25 years ago in the intelligence forces of the Israeli Army, kind of equivalent unit to the NSA. Have a PhD in artificial intelligence and machine learning, focusing on cyber. Established almost 8 companies in the cyber domain, from endpoint protection, data analysis, threat team, and etc. In between, I served 4 years in Washington as the international CTO for Lockheed, leading the technology and cyber projects for Lockheed and the federal government outside of the U.S. And then I was the head of security for Daimler, Mercedes-Benz, doing cool stuff with cyber around automotive, drone, robotics, and smart manufacturing. So yes, not like Joel. I'm coming from the deep technology, from cyber perspective, less in the research part, but more from the practical part. I'm a nation level, what states to be kind of a nation level hacker. So I'm from the breaking stuff perspective, and this is why we are kind of completing each other. My experience, for example, and Joel, who is leading our customer support, sales engineer team.
Well, how did you both come to Opora? Is this a company that you both have started together?
I joined Opora 8 weeks ago, and coming from other perspective and taking the challenge of bringing Opora to a new domain that I felt is a new ocean, which is more the ecosystem risk and supplier risk coming on organization, which was one of the key issues that I deal with when I was in Lockheed a few years ago, but it was behind the scenes back then. And I will let Joel, which was in the company way before my time, to answer it himself.
Yes, that's correct. So I joined Opora back in January of 2020, literally just before the pandemic hit. I came to Apollo because I'm based in the United States, which you probably can't tell from this accent, but I'm based here in the U.S., and my last few roles have been working specifically for startups, and especially Israeli startups. So I was looking for another opportunity that would fit into that wheelhouse, and thankfully at the time, Apollo were looking for some U.S. representation. So it all worked out well.
Excellent. Now, when was Apollo founded? And another question I have for you is, what does Apollo mean? How did you get that name?
So Apollo was founded around about 3 years ago, in April of 2019, and it was founded by a gentleman called Yuval Diskin, who has come out of the Israeli intelligence services, out of the Shin Bet, as it's called in Israel, and really wanted to start applying the sort of questions that people are asking around terrorism and nation state activity and apply the same to cyber as opposed to looking necessarily at tools and weapons. We really wanted to take a look at who are these people, what do they do, how do they work.
Okay. So what does Apollo mean exactly? How did you get that name?
I think it means sense in Czech Republic, no? If I correct me, Joel?
I think you are correct, although I could not remember whether it was Czech or whether it was another Eastern European language, but you are correct. That's where it stems from.
Okay. Now, where is Apollo? Where is your headquarters located? Are you in Tel Aviv, Israel, or... do you have offices in other countries other than just New York and Israel?
So Apollo is headquartered in a city called Ra'anana, Israel, which is just slightly north of Tel Aviv. It's in the Tel Aviv municipal area, so you know, not far from anybody who's visiting Tel Aviv. We also have representation here in New York City, in Manhattan. And that's where we have physical locations right now. Of course, we have customers around the world that you know, we can certainly attend to if necessary.
Okay. Now, who is your customer, your typical customer base profile? Is it the SMB, the Fortune 500, government, or perhaps all of them, maybe a combination of all of them?
Our customer profile is not necessarily by size, but what their needs and requirements are. So they do tend to be enterprise level. We do have some SMBs as well, and especially those who may not have, you know, either their in-house cyber or risk type people and might want to or might need to have to outsource that. They are the sort of people we're looking for. But as I mentioned, it's not necessarily type or size of customer, but more of what their needs are, especially those who have a great deal of third parties or suppliers, because as you well know, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in a moment, supply chain risk is paramount these days.
Right. Now, let's get into your product offering. I've been at your website quite a bit, and it seems like to me that your company focuses pretty much on like risk quantification, like quantifying risk for cybersecurity for your clients. Am I correct?
Yeah, so you are correct. What we are offering is the ability to take a look at the holistic ecosystem and quantify the risk there, but quantify it for business people. We don't actually speak in cyber language because that always needs some type of translation to the business type people. We are essentially offering that translation. We're going to take the derived macro risk into your business and offer actionable remediation steps that you can take. One of the other things that we do, and I kind of prefaced this in my earlier answer, is that We do a profile the threat actors behind these attacks and campaigns, but again, we're not necessarily in what they're calling themselves. We're not really interested in their weapons per se. We don't look at file hashes or executables or anything like that. We're much more interested in how the people behind the keyboards operate. Again, this comes from the security services backgrounds. We're trying to identify, you know, the people that make up these, for want of a better word, cells, and try to understand how they are operating. How do they collaborate? Who are they attacking? How are they attacking? What is their ingress point rather than, you know, the weapons that they use? So, you know, all of that rolls up into giving our customers the ability to quantify the risk and their entire ecosystem, which of course does include suppliers and third parties and companies that these organizations work with.
Okay. Now, here, at least in the United States, Joel, there's about 3,000 cyber vendors, and they all kind of have, at least they claim to have their own form of threat intelligence platforms. I've interviewed many of them. What makes you different from the other 3,000 vendors that are out there? What makes a Forest stand out from the crowd? Your platform?
That's a great question, Ravi, and you know, it's one of those that if I could pull something out of the air, you know, it would make my job a lot easier, because you are right. We get thrown in with threat intelligence and especially threat intelligence platforms all the time, and you know, some of the challenges with startups is getting your name out there and telling people what you do and trying to get them to understand what you do. So, you know, some of the differences are, once again, I've alluded to this in my previous answers, but we're not necessarily looking at the sort of indicators of compromise that a lot of these other threat intel platforms are looking at. What we're looking at in our key differentiators is our ability to quantify these threats that come from the business ecosystem, and especially those that attack the business that are not necessarily always looked at from a cyber point of view. So geopolitical information, changes in weather. A lot of the customers we work with are in things like transportation. So, you know, a lot of these things, which you don't necessarily think of when you jump out in mind, when you think about cyber, you're thinking about hacks, you're thinking about people leaving malicious data and trying to extort you for data. We're taking a look at, again, the whole enterprises ecosystem, which includes things that don't necessarily fall under the umbrella of cyber.
Okay, excellent. Now, it sounds like you're monitoring the infrastructure that these threat actors use to deliver their attacks rather than concentrating on the weaponization and the IOC indicators of compromise. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. As I mentioned before, so this is, again, one of our key differentiators that, you know, when we're not necessarily producing threat bulletins that give a background on this particular threat actor and all of their weapons and the file hashes and their IP addresses and domains and et cetera, that you expect to see in indicators of compromise. One of the problems with indicators of compromise that we look at it is that it's always, by definition, reactive. Something has to have happened. Somebody needs to report that as an indicator of compromise, and it gets listed as an IOC. So, again, there's a lag here. Somebody has to be attacked and may unfortunately be a victim of that attack before the world at large knows about it. So, again, what we are looking at is the infrastructure itself. Our thesis is essentially it doesn't matter who you are, whether you are a nation state, whether you are a script kiddie. If you want to launch a cyber attack against somebody, you need infrastructure to do that from. So what we're way more interested in is not what you're launching from that infrastructure, but how did you create that infrastructure? Was it, you know, are you going to a bulletproof hoster? Are you a nation state and you can compromise legitimate domains? What is the expertise of this? Not all attacks, not all campaigns have the same level. I would be much more worried about a nation state actor these days than I am necessarily a script kiddie, although we've seen in the news that, you know, even immature people can cause a lot of destruction out there from a cyber point of view. So, again, instead of the typical tip looking at things like hashes and IOCs, we're much more interested in the infrastructure itself, the expertise of the people behind this infrastructure, their complexity, how persistent they are. And all of that basically rolls into the risk factors and remediation steps that we can give risk management teams at our customers and prospects.
Thank you. Now, these last few years, we've seen unprecedented global conditions happening. For example, the COVID-19 pandemic, nobody ever thought that the world would turn upside down the way it has been. Everybody thought that it would be localized to China. And just recently, we're seeing the situation with Russia and Ukraine. How has that, in your opinion, changed the cyber threat landscape?
It's changed it dramatically because I think people are now really starting to think that and realize that it's not just their own systems that need protection from threats out there. It is their customer systems. It is their third-party systems. It is the greater world in general. And I think the first instance of that we saw was COVID. And COVID wasn't necessarily COVID itself, but it was also the work from home. People shifted their manners of working and shifted their manners of commuting, but still needed to get online, still needed to collaborate, still needed to do their job. And, the attackers out there realized this and started attacking not necessarily the customer themselves, but maybe the VPN platform that was in use or a communication platform that was in use or some other financial systems. You could look at the recent things like SolarWinds and the Acelion and attacks like that, which compromised a supplier of those customers, and there were multiple customers, rather than the end entity itself. So organizations certainly started to understand that there was a impact to the business at whole, not solely their digital and cyber platforms. So, and all of these became part of the bigger scope of the political and potential threats out there, together with the threat actors' motivations and capabilities. Of course, even for things like COVID, you probably saw emails, phishing emails, trying to get you to look at the latest, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, or here are the figures on COVID infections and deaths around the world. We saw all of that when COVID was going on. Now, unfortunately, we've seen the activities going on in Ukraine and Russia. There are different geopolitical incidents, but the same issues as regarding business systems risks apply here. So, unfortunately, this is the nature of the world we live in. And once again, I just think more and more businesses are seeing that this cyber rolls up into a bigger business risk that they have to take into account.
Right. Now, how is Oporo leveraging itself as a company to deal with these issues and future issues that would be totally unpredictable?
Again, a lot of what we do is this is the way that we believe the systems are acting, and this would be the logical next step. So what we're essentially doing from a technical point of view is we have cognitive intelligence models that combine the typical cyber information that other threat intel providers will do, such as DNS information, file hashes that I mentioned before, dark web activity, and the like, but also marry that to external evaluative sources. And again, we've discussed some of these, the geopolitical, weather events, social media and networks, holiday and events going on around the world, especially if we know that you know, that there is a national religious holiday and people might, you know, drop their guards for a few days or might not be as vigilant, then that might be a good time to expect some sort of events to go on. So all of this information, both that on the cyber side and also on the more business risk side, is rolled up into basically a score profiling, excuse me, each entity that's in your business ecosystem and the potential risk that it might have impacting your organization.
Okay. So let's can you do a deeper dive into that. How do you help your clients transform that cyber risk into business risk so that they can understand better of how what they need to do to protect themselves or put those controls in place?
Yeah, so that, again, this is something that really differentiates us because, as I mentioned before, we don't necessarily talk cyber to our customers. Instead, we are communicating the risk that's involved here together with the remediation and prescriptive actions to combat any risk and potential business loss. So what we actually do is we have a portal that you can consider essentially a transition layer. It's basically a UI, but a UI to be used by business-type people. Or even roles such as your chief risk officer or your insurance and cyber underwriters that will allow them to essentially look at this information and easily understand what needs to be done, if anything. So, again, all of our messaging, all of our outputs are essentially in a business and risk style, and we are targeting business executives, not just the CISO. So, again, taking this outside of cyber and introducing it to the other business functions within the organization. So, again, allowing these folks to easily understand what is going on and what needs to be done to reduce any risk that's inherent.
Okay. Now, we were talking before the show started. We were talking about supply chain risk, like we've seen solar winds. Do you help third parties that are compromised in these supply chain attacks? So, for example, do you help any of the victims that were impacted by solar winds? Like, there are over 200 entities that were impacted, you know, from the U.S. federal government to the Fortune 100, the smallest of mom and pops. Were you able to help any of them out sort through what happened?
So that you know, somewhat unfortunately, that was a good example of something that was exceptionally reactive, and it took actually a while for people to understand what's going on. But it's certainly something that we are implemented to hopefully help with the next type of that attack. And unfortunately, from what I've seen out there, there will be another one of these attacks. But the sort of things that we're trying to implement is that this kind of translation portal that I've just described will also have that capability of allowing you to collaborate and communicate with your third party and supply chain. So, for example, if we saw an increase in the risk score for if we saw an increase in a risk score for one of our customers' supply chain partners, we would not only notify the customer itself, they would also have the ability to ensure that they could get that messaging out to their third party and collaborate not only with them, but with law professionals as well, if necessary.
Okay, excellent. Now, do you have any customer success stories that you can share with us without giving any confidential information out? Do you have any use cases you can discuss?
Yes, I can talk at a high level about one of our customers who approached us because they had a SIM system, essentially, you know, a place where they grabbed and stored all of their logs around all of their systems and platforms and networks, and wanted to use the information that we were provided to essentially scan through all of those logs and see if they could surface any, you know, unwanted communications, any ingress points, anybody trying to attach or connect to systems that they shouldn't. And this is the customer in question is an exceptionally large global pharmaceutical company. Obviously, has a very extensive networks and platforms and a very large number of third-party suppliers and customers. So, there was a lot of information there. One of the advantages to our outputs is that, that output is in a standard format and can be easily integrated into a SIM or SOAR system to basically expose this information, again, in an easy-to-understand manner. So that is an example of something that we've done so far. We have quite a large number of POCs going on at the moment that fall more into the risk area that I've been describing, and hopefully I'll be able to tell you more about those in a few months' time.
Okay,
yeah, I just want to mention another scenario that can be relevant. Again, they are not directly our customer, but the case is exactly this. Is attack on one of the suppliers of Japanese OEM. It was on the news, but the perspective was that the attackers attack the plastic manufacturing in Indonesia that's making the dashboard plastic for the big OEM, which is in Japan. And the ransom claim came to the OEM and not to the supplier because they understand they can pay for it. So this is a classic example for a risk that we are monitoring, which is an operational risk that it's not a cyber per se, as Joel say, on the OEM from Japan. There was no incident that the CISO can handle, but there was a CISO, a cyber risk that impact the supplier. And based on this, the derived risk caused to an operational problem or operational resilience in the OEM business. And at the end of the game, the OEM paid the ransomware, even though he wasn't getting the ransomware himself on his network, but just because he wanted his systems up and running back. So this is another case study that, again, part of it was in the news, not all of the details, of course, but that is reflecting some of the challenges and information that we are giving to our customer and to our potential new customer, which is under a POC at this moment.
Okay, well, that brings up another question I want to ask you. I just wrote an article last week about whether to pay a ransom, the actual ransom payment or not. What are your thoughts on that, both of you, Joel and Ronan? Should that ransom payment be made or not? Because here in the U.S., the insurance companies are not even giving a payout in case you do make a ransom payment. You will not get reimbursed for that if you file a claim. What are your thoughts on that?
I'll give my thoughts, and I'm sure that Ronan will chime in with his. My thoughts are, somewhat similar to, nation-state terrorism. You paying a ransom does not mean that you either get your data back untouched or that you won't be attacked again. There's been plenty of examples in the news recently where people have paid a ransom and they've either been re-attacked and had data exfiltrated again, or they paid the ransom and the operators, the attackers may have given the data back, they may have given a subset or the entire data back, but they've kept a copy for themselves. So, I would say that paying ransom does not necessarily get you back to where you were before, and it certainly doesn't protect you from anything happening again. I think, a lot of the cyber underwriters are realizing this, and you are right, Rafi, they are not paying out necessarily if you're paying a ransom. So, anyway, that's my view.
Ronan, do you have any
views? I tend to agree with the general. I think it's like any terror event, the main goal is not to pay ransomware or to release people, but, and there is a big but, many organizations, mainly in the SMB market, which don't have a good disaster recovery and backup capabilities, but do have an insurance, And again, the insurance policy in these days are more tough, I agree, because they used to pay a lot in the last 2 years, and now they put more restriction. But if the CEO don't have a good recovery and backup processes, and his business is down and he have an insurance, he will pay the ransom. So if you see some statistics, yeah, they pay less, and they, even if they pay, they don't necessarily get the data back, or it doesn't block them as trusted to not be re-attacked in the future. But in many cases, the CEO wants their business to be back up and running, so they do pay. And I think the latest statistics that I have seen, non-officially, last week in the dark web, there are a lot of, you know, lists of companies who pays. There are still hundreds of companies paying ransomware every day around the globe. So it's still popular, very popular, unfortunately, but it's the reality.
And I would say that, you know, our intent here, Paula, is to hopefully help our prospects and customers before they hit that stage. So, you know, the touch words, which you can't see me doing here, it's something that we hope none of our customers have to work with.
Right. Now, as a company, Opora, what markets are you? What other markets are you looking at penetrating into down the road here?
So we essentially are working with customers who, again, have a fairly extensive supply chain requirements, and that tend to be in markets such as energy, insurance, automotive, and transportation. So they're the areas that we're looking at right now, and I'm sure as we get out there and people come and understand what we do, that we will identify other use cases for other markets as well.
Okay. Do you offer any free trials or demos of your product for customers before you onboard them?
Yes, we do. We have all of the above. In fact, we are about to release imminently our what we're calling our Lead Gen tool, which is essentially a freeware version of the entire Opora platform. So we can get a taste of the sort of outputs that you would get tailored to your company and the markets your company is in and works with. And, you know, like most freeware things, it's a little taster with a if you want to drill down here or you want to know more, please contact us. But we've got some really good feedback from the prospects who have used that, and indeed they've led to a number of POCs that are going on right now.
Cool, excellent. Now, how do your customers actually access the data? Is it available in the cloud like Azure or AWS, and how secure is it?
Correct. So we use the leading cloud technologies out there with the enhanced security that they have. We are completely SaaS. There is nothing for a customer to install. There's nothing for a customer to necessarily run. All they really need is a browser to get to their portal that they can get their data. Of course, as I mentioned previously, we do have other data exports that you can use to integrate with other systems, but that's that's an over and above thing rather than base functionality of the platform. So no, we are completely SaaS right now and take advantage of the availability and security and redundancy inherent in those platforms.
Okay. Do you sell directly to the customers, or do you depend upon a partner relationship model?
Again, it's all of the above. We have customers who we work with directly. We have a partner that we work with as well, both in, third-party vendor type partners, but also OEM partnerships as well. We have an OEM partnership with a very large security vendor here in the U.S., and we've got some joint customers coming out of that OEM. So we are certainly looking to sell both direct, but also from long-term partners and VARs.
Okay, excellent. Now, before we wrap up our show, I just kind of want to touch base on some of the other issues in cyber, which may or may not affect you completely as a company, but what I want to ask you about is the Internet of Things. As we know, that's kind of where everything's all connected together. I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy. I really hate technology, if you ask me my opinion. But what are your thoughts on the Internet of Things? I find it's a very scary proposition to have everything so connected together. I just believe it increases the attack surface for the cyber attacker. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you have like a smart home or a smart car or anything in that realm of smart?
So, yes, I'll just give you my thoughts off my top of my head here. But, I am a techie person. I am pretty well connected. You know, I've got a number of smart devices in the house. But I try to segregate them from any PII or financial information that this house is. Am I stringent about that? No, but then again, I don't really have much that you would be interested in. At least I don't think so. But that being said, you bring up a good point. It's not necessarily that it's the Internet of Things per se. It's the fact that you have additional devices out there that are on your network, and because they are devices on the network, typically with an IP, they might not have a very good inherent inbuilt security. It's just another. You can think of it basically putting another endpoint out there, and the more endpoints you have out there, as you rightly said, Ravi, that increases your attack surface area. And again, you know, these devices themselves may not have inbuilt things like firewalls, like your Windows or Mac desktop or laptop would have, or your cell phone or whatever. I've seen instances where they've had extremely weak root or admin passwords, if they have those at all, and can easily be broken in. So again, I would be more concerned, not necessarily that it's the Internet of Things per se, but then you've just got additional devices out there exposed to the public Internet that essentially could be another attack vector.
Great. Okay. Now, another one I want to ask you about is artificial intelligence. That's a big buzzword that's been kind of thrown about the cyber industry and all these overused techno jargons. AI can be used for the good and for the bad. I wrote a whole book, actually, on artificial intelligence. It came out last year in print. What are your, and Ronan, especially since you have a doctorate in AI, what are your thoughts on AI in general? Is it just an overused term, or is it going to come to the day where everything will be so automated that we don't have to worry about anything? What are your thoughts on that?
So AI, you know, it's a big buzzword in the cyber and marketing domain. All the marketing guys really like to use it, but at the end of the day, it's a set of if-what questions that have a checklist behind it that can call it artificial intelligence in most cases. But it's just kind of my answer combining also to your previous question. I think, you know, you cannot stop technology, and technology must run, and AI give us better capability, faster decision, faster feedback, and it will be part of our life. So we need somehow, you know, to find the balance between how we can move forward, growth, our life, our business, our mission, make it our life even more efficient. But on the other end, still, as Joe said, be secure and making sure at least the sensitive part of us being safe. Now, hackers definitely understand the value of AI or automation, let's call it for a moment, or smart automation, because they do what they call a viral attack. With the same vulnerability, they can attack hundreds of customers on the same time with the same technique, very, very cheap, and their chances to succeed are much higher. But since they're doing it faster, the organization will need to develop its own AI defense capabilities in order to protect it. One of the biggest trends that you can see the statistics is what's called the one day zero day attack, which in the past the zero day of course was unknown, but no one wants to waste his zero day because he wants to keep it to something special. So there is a whole of history around AI that's called one day, which means they automated the 0 day a minute after it's published the next day, and they run it out there automatically. And why is that? Because most of the organizations are not updated from the threat in advance or don't have automation in their defense capability. So the attacker are using the gap between the fast exploitation out there and the low response time and patch management from the organization side. And this gives them a huge, huge, huge advantage. So, yeah, so if the bad guys are using AI, I think the good ones or the defenders will need also to use AI in more and more practical areas. And yeah, I think this is, at the end of the day, this is where the industry, from both sides of it, from the dark side of it and from the good side of it, will invest more and more. Again, I call it smart automation, because I'm not the marketing guy, but yeah, you can call it, you know, AI.
Okay. Excellent. Now, one more issue, the remote workforce. Now, this was a concept that originally thought was going to happen like maybe 4 or 5 years down the road, but COVID made it happen a lot, lot sooner. How has the remote workforce affected your company, your clients, and do you expect that this remote workforce will be a permanent fixture now in the world economy?
So I will answer this, and again, it's coming from two reasons. One, the remote workforce created a situation that the network perimeter of my organization is no longer just my network inside organization, but also my supplier's network, my employees' home network, and everyone that is working from remote, their home and local network become part in some way of my network. And this is going back to your IoT stuff, but just from a different direction, you know, it's dramatically increased the attack landscape or the potential threat vectors that then attackers can do. On our business, as I said, if a company needs that their suppliers will work from remote and the supplier is not secure enough, then the hacker will attack me as an organization through my supplier. It's easier, it's cheaper, it's much more convenient. Through the supplier, again, he may be a supplier for few customers. I can approach few of them, not just one. So those suppliers become very critical part of the chain much faster due to COVID and the remote work, and not just the employees that everyone's talking about, but those guys, suppliers, partners, customers, vendors, doesn't matter. They also got into this pool of chain due to this remote work.
Okay. Finally, as we wrap up our show, what do you think both of you think on the hot button topics that cyber will be for the rest of this year and perhaps even going into next year?
So I think a continuing of this, what does the workplace mean? Questions that arose when people started to work from home during COVID-19. I think that's still going to be an issue that a lot of organizations have to get their head around. I don't believe, you know, I'm here in Manhattan, although people have come back to the offices, it certainly wasn't like it was, you know, 2.5 years ago. And I don't personally believe that for a lot of enterprises that will change. I think people will get used to either being remote workers or hybrid, and that comes with its own challenges, some of which that Roland just alluded to. So I certainly think that's going to continue to be an issue. Expanding on that, supply chain attacks, which we've discussed throughout this call, are certainly going to be as prevalent as Ronan just said. A lot of attackers are realizing that to attack a supplier might be easier than attacking the end goal itself. And one of the advantages of attacking a supplier is that you attack that, that opens up a large number of potential victims to you. Again, we saw that with SolarWinds. So I certainly think they are going to be continue to be big. The only other one that really comes to mind at the moment, and this doesn't really change from items I've gone in the past, is that we have a number of events coming up. We've got I'm originally from the UK, so I'm very much into my soccer or football, as we call it, and we've got the World Cup coming up, being held in Qatar. So that on its own is a big event, and once again, from a third-party point of view, you could see, you know, phishing sites being set up for people looking for tickets and things like that. So, you know, certainly where we're going is just really expanding on what's happened over the last couple of years.
Okay. Ronan, do you have any thoughts of what the landscape could look like?
No, I totally agree with Joel. And again, we talk about it, the suppliers. And again, suppliers can be the big, you know, cloud vendors. You know, there are also suppliers that are moving to the cloud and all the risk there. 5G networks and satellite networks are also suppliers. Smart cities and autonomous vehicle is changing. But it all came about, you know, different data sources, data that you need to trust, data coming from different dimension, different direction, different suppliers. And I really think that the ecosystem trust and one of the biggest one, as I said, you can talk about it from 20 different angles, and for each one of them there is a security product or a security vendor that's trying to tackle it, but if we really look on the root of the problem, it's really the digital connectivity or the digital landscape that is growing fast and enabled to do business today and grow the business and make your business more efficient and more profitable. But these are exactly the areas that open the new threats. And the challenge will be, we had a kind of award in Daimler that for the AMG, for the racing cars, that the racing cars will drive faster if the brakes will work better. So yes, you need security. You need a very good security, but it cannot stop you. It needs to enable you to run faster or to drive faster because this is your way to grow. And I think this will be the biggest challenge that the business leader will need to find the right balance between their growth, the business need, the business resilience, and the cyber landscape. And I think this will be the next 6 years, this will be the biggest challenge.
Excellent. Now, Joel and Ronan, what is the best way for someone to contact you in case they're interested in talking to you more or are interested in your services?
The best way is to contact us via our website, which is opora.io, so that is opora.io, and we have a number of forms on there, depending on what you're interested in, that will more likely route through me in one way or another, so I'll be happy to talk to anybody who is interested in learning what we do and finding out more information for themselves.
Ronan, Joel, thank you for your time this morning here in Chicago, on Chicago Time. We hope to have you get on another podcast. It's been definitely a great conversation.
Great. Thank you for hosting us today, Ravi.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.